Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good, good, good. Making sure people are not choking on their lunch. Anyway, it is a pleasure to be here. I'm very glad to be invited to deliver this lecture, and thank you to the faculty for the opportunity to talk a little bit about the work that we've been doing, and give you a chance to get a chance to see the work that we're doing and where we're taking this work. So what I'm going to be doing today actually is talking about the arch of a project that we completed in February. It was a five-year project in trying to address a very simple question, but very difficult to do. It's how do you take an intervention that has been developed for a different group of people, for a different group of providers, and implement it somewhere else and try to address the local needs of a community? And how do we move an intervention in that sense and the science around it, and how we use implementation science to do that. So that's what I'll be talking about in the next hour or so. And if there's any questions, please feel free to ask. And if you don't understand something I'm saying, that's fine. I have an accent. I don't mind. And I have some words in English will never come out in English. I'll try to say them in Spanish if I can. So please feel free to interrupt me in any way you can. So before I begin, I do want to acknowledge sort of the people who have provided support, as well as the team that has been involved in this project. We've been at it for almost 10 years now, and we've been very lucky to be funded by New York State Office of Mental Health. We've been a major funder of this work, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, as well as the NIH. And none of this work would be possible without the collaborators, the students, the community stakeholders who were part of this project. This is all about how do you take an intervention and really work with community partners, with community providers on making an intervention salient to that community, to the providers, to the clients. And all these people have been involved in many ways. So I'm here sort of speaking for them, but I'm trying to represent the work that we've done as a team. And it's a great team of people to work with. I see research is a team sport, and the best thing that you can do is to have a great team sort of supporting your work, and they're smarter than you, and they're helping you sort of throughout this process. So these are all the great people who I've had the pleasure to work with and are part of our team. So to begin, I do want to sort of put things into context. And there's two contexts I want you to sort of try to wrap your brains around and try to understand. First of all, it's this context of the cycle for comorbidity. The work that we've been doing has focused on people that have serious mental illness as well as a chronic medical condition. They're living with these two very chronic issues and trying to survive, to recover, to manage both the serious mental illness, the schizophrenia, the depression, the bipolar disorder, as well as diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease. And being involved in managing these two illnesses and people being very aware of how these illnesses impact their lives. And the first quote actually is one of the ones that I like best. So someone talking about in an interview with us, a Dominican woman with depression, hypertension, diabetes, and arthritis, saying, "I'm sick from head to toe," and having to manage everything that happens from the physical health side of things to the mental health side of things, and people being very aware of how one thing influences the other. So the interventions that we're going to be talking about really try to manage these things in conjunction as the whole person, the whole aspect of what's happening. But then the other component of this context is that this doesn't happen in a vacuum. These are people who are struggling within a healthcare system that's out there actually is very fragmented and is sometimes against what they're trying to do, trying to navigate from the mental health system to the primary care system. And for many people, it's a labyrinth. People get lost. People don't get the care that they need. And here in that navigation is where you start seeing things of culture, language, physical and mental health issues. And this is a quote from an administrator that really encapsulates sort of the problems that we were facing. These are people, our patients, partly because of their illness, their cultural, their language issues, because the system is not very well organized, they get lost in the system. The patient just gets overwhelmed. You're not feeling well. You may have symptoms of psychosis. You don't speak the language. You're trying to figure out what office to go. It can be overwhelming. It can be overwhelming for the patient. They get frustrated and they don't care. They don't get the care that they need. And this is sort of the population we're working with, people where you have serious mental illness, physical health issues, you're a minority, you might not speak English very well, and it's up to you to navigate that system that sometimes don't talk to each other. And so the impetus of the work that I'm going to present today is actually trying to figure out how to help someone navigate that system, how to help that person get the care that they need. And that's one aspect of how to fix this problem. Another way of fixing this problem, which we're not going to talk about today, is to destroy the system and build it all over again and not help someone navigate this labyrinth. But that's sort of where we're at, how to navigate that labyrinth. And I'm happy to sort of discuss sort of where we are at this point. So what I got talk to you today is about the health disparities of these intersections of being a Latino and having a serious mental illness and the health inequities that they face. Present factors that shape the healthcare experiences, what happens when a Latino, a Dominican, a Puerto Rican go and seek care from the primary care system and they have a serious mental illness, what are their experiences? What have we learned from their experiences? And then how we have used that information to develop, to adapt a culturally adapted healthcare manager intervention that helps someone navigate from the mental health system to the primary care system. So that's sort of the journey I'm going to take you on today. So just to give you some context, there is a public health crisis among people with serious mental illness. People that have schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, schizoaffective disorder, are dying at a much younger age than the general population. Estimates that have a 25%, most likely 20 to 15 years younger. And this is mostly due to cardiovascular disease. Mostly due to the chronic illnesses that are impacting the entire general population, but for this group of individuals, it's disproportionately impacting them due to multiple constellations of factors that we're going to be talking about. So this is sort of our population that we're talking about, people that have serious mental illness and also are facing serious chronic medical conditions in their lives. Our work then took that and looked at the intersection of having a serious mental illness and also being a minority in this country, particularly Latino. And the assumption that we had when we started it was that if you have these two statuses, you might have a double health burden. We know there are health disparities among Latinos in this country, and we also know there are disparities among people that have serious mental illness. What happens if you have those two intersections? And believe it or not, there was not a lot of research being done in this area. So we did a systematic lit review several years ago where we looked at 30 different articles that have looked at that intersection, and we began to find some evidence indicating increased risk for cardiovascular-related mortality, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and the negative metabolic abnormality associated with taking second-generation antipsychotic, meaning that someone who was taking second-generation antipsychotic, they would gain more weight, a Latino will gain more weight than a non-Hispanic white. The issue with this literature, there was some evidence indicating this, but when you really look at the studies, it is not very good science, meaning the evidence is inconclusive. First of all, these are very small samples. These are all clinical samples, so people being treated in the system, and few analyses actually stratify people by Latino groups, so Mexican, Puerto Ricans, high acculturation, low acculturation years in the U.S., and most importantly, by gender, which we know health disparities are impacted by gender. Diabetes, cardiovascular disease have gender differences. So we found some evidence of this double health burden, but it's inconclusive. And actually, if you're a doctoral student and want an area of research for figuring out what their disparity is, a great area, because there is this need to understand where those disparities are and that it's not unique, not uniform across the great diversity of Latino populations. So we found some inconclusive evidence regarding these disparities. We also began to look at what might be influences those inequities in health. So there's a constellation of factors out there that people know about, all from the environment all the way to health behaviors. And there's evidence out there that all of this influences the health of Latinos as well as the health of people with serious mental illness and the intersection of that. And today we're going to focus on the medical care. So the factors that influence how people access and use and engage in medical care services to address their health inequities. And that's sort of the interventions that we're going to talk about. I have other work that we have begun to look at health behaviors as another target of intervention. And there's an enormous need to look at the environmental factors as well. And we can talk in the Q&A. I'm more than happy to ask to answer some of the thoughts that we have on how to bring all of this together. But today I'm going to talk about sort of medical care, those aspects that really influences how people use and engage in care. So the first thing that we did was actually to do a mixed method study to examine what is the experience that Latinos in the public mental health system had when they went and sought help in the primary care services. What happened to them? What were their experiences seeking care in that environment? And what we did was a mixed method study at one of our community clinics where people, these are mostly Latino, mostly Dominicans, about 40 of them. We did structured interviews with them about their use of services, their experiences, their perceptions of the quality of care. And then we did focus group with them about their experiences with their providers. And we began to identify what were sort of what happened when they went to primary care in the community. This was done in Washington Heights, northern Manhattan. And these are people in the public mental health system going out and seeking care in primary care services in their community. And what we generated from this study was a grounded model approach, or a grounded model of their experiences. And one thing became very clear. Everyone, every single patient talked about are navigating a stressed healthcare system. A primary care system that's fragmented, that you go there, you talk to a doctor, you come back, and the doctors don't talk to each other. Every time you go, there's a long waiting time. Every time you go, you see a new doctor. You have to retell your story. You have to retell your needs. And even in Washington Heights, even in a place where a lot of people speak Spanish, encountering major language barriers, meaning not being able to have a provider that spoke Spanish, even in Washington Heights. So all of the thing was sort of, that's the way you look for services for this population. The other common aspect was experiences of perceived discrimination and stigma. So going to the doctor, going to a primary care clinic, and experiencing discrimination and stigma because of multiple identities that the person carries. So one of them was 75% of the people who participated in the study said that racism is a problem in our healthcare system, and that people are treated unjustly because of multiple identities, being Latino, not speaking English very well, having a serious mental illness, being an immigrant, being Black. And all of that influenced how people navigated and engaged with care. Qualitatively, what was more interesting, actually, for intervention development, what would that look like? What was the experience of actually being discriminated or stigmatized because of that? And here's an example of what that looked like. This is a classic example of diagnostic overshadowing. Here's someone that has schizophrenia, goes to the hospital, saying their stomach hurt, and being almost ignored. And basically say, that's in your head, you take a Tylenol, go away. And the person actually ended up having appendicitis. And this was a common experience, and it's a common experience not only in the Latino community, a common experience among people with serious mental illness, where they present to a doctor with a physical health complaint, and the moment they are seen taking an antipsychotic medication or having a mental health issue, the mental health takes over. The clinician goes to the mental health instead of the physical health, and the person having to navigate that after. And this was a common experience, and then on top of that, having a minority status influences that. So that is a really important aspect in helping someone navigate the system, that this is some of the experiences they're going to face when they're trying to get healthcare. The other component at the end of the day was that experiences with that health provider. So that interpersonal connection that they made with that provider, with their primary care physician. And here it was interesting. These are people who are actually seeking care. They are actually connecting to primary care. They're going to primary care services. What was that experience like? And we had actually a really interesting approach where some people talked about very positive experiences, a provider who showed personal attention, was warm, and was culturally congruent. It basically showed respeto, showed personalismo, the person cared about them, versus other experiences related to stigma in personal aspect, being disrespectful, the provider never looking at the patient in the eye, always being in the computer taking notes. That type of experience really resonated with clients. That interpersonal aspect of care was a really important aspect of how they experienced that. And then we saw low levels of patient-centered care. We had several measures on particularly self-efficacy, to talking to your doctor, to managing chronic illness. We had a great measure of the patient's perception of illness care, which is basically, during the past 6 months, have your doctor done, and then a list of services that they should be receiving if you have a chronic medical illness. For example, did the doctor give you a list of your medication? Did the doctor talk to you about your treatment plan? Do you feel your doctors are communicating with each other? and patients, Latino patients, really reporting very low levels of that type of care being received. So with this in mind and having this understanding, then we began to think about what type of interventions can we use? What type of interventions can address these healthcare experiences and help address some of these barriers that people were experiencing? So for us, when we looked at this, we examined that there's healthcare manager interventions that really target this type of approach. And these interventions are basically doing two things. They're coordinating care. They're helping someone go from one system of care to the other, helping with that with system fragmentation, with language barrier. You have someone who's really helping you go to the doctor and come back to your psychiatrist and making sure the providers are communicating and sharing treatment information, medications, treatment decisions. But that healthcare manager also is working with you individually around goal setting, patient activation, problem solving, basically helping you become more involved in your own healthcare. Someone that you can go there and talk to you about how do you take your medication, what do you need to do, prepare you to the primary care visit so that you are more empowered to receive the care that you need. So the healthcare manager is really working at two levels, actually at three levels. It's really working at the patient level as well as the provider level. And there was an intervention out there that had particularly focused with people with serious mental illness. The primary care assessment, referral, and evaluation intervention developed by Benjamin Dross at Emory University, who had recently done an RCT that looked at all these components. The intervention had assessment and planning, meaning someone was basically providing and organizing a comprehensive health assessment for the client, worked on care coordination and client activation, and the idea was that the person then received preventive primary care, improved quality of life, and general health status. This is a healthcare manager. It's basically a nurse who's at the outpatient mental health clinic, is working individually with the client and helping that person navigate with primary care. So an intervention out there seemed to address the issues that we had identified at our local clinic with our local population. However, when we looked at the evidence, we found some really important local implementation gaps. The number one thing is that the intervention had not been tested with Latinos. When we looked at this RCT, only 8 Latinos were included in the entire RCT. So we had no idea, is this going to work with our population? It hasn't been tested. The population in that trial was in Atlanta, Georgia, was 75% African-American, and then whites, and then 6 Latinos. So we have no idea, is this going to work? The other component was the influence of culture. How is culture involved in the healthcare of this individual? And in this literature, the more and more I read about it and learn about it, issues of cultures are often ignored. Meaning someone has a serious mental illness, that tends to take away their culture. It's like it's all about serious mental illness. Well, no, the person also might speak a different language, might have different beliefs, might come from a different minority status or anything else. And culture is really important here because it's how people talk about their physical health issues, how they describe their symptoms, how they engage with the healthcare system, and how they manage the important aspects that have to do with chronic illness, their diet, their exercise, their environment. So culture become a really important aspect, and this was ignored in this literature, very little being discussed about. And this continues to this day. For example, there's a classic, a really good systematic lit review on almost all interventions done for people with serious mental illness on their healthcare. And they looked at pharmacological interventions, psychosocial interventions, healthcare manner, lifestyle, issues of cultures and minority are not even mentioned in a systematic review of that nature. So this is a really big area, and it does influence how you deliver care if you ignore cultural aspects. And then for our context, we wanted an intervention that social workers, master-level social workers, can deliver because we didn't have too many registered nurses to take this on. So can social workers, with the right supervision, with the right training, can they take on this healthcare manager role? So those were the implementation gaps we wanted to address. And here's where implementation science comes into play, where instead of us as researchers saying, okay, we have the gap, we have an intervention, we'll go back to our offices and we sort of figure out what the intervention is, then we'll bring it to the clinic and we'll test it. We said, no, why don't we work with the community? Why don't we go to the outpatient mental health clinic and we build this intervention from the ground up? We actually engage the people who are going to deliver the intervention, who are going to administer the intervention, who are going to manage this program. How do we engage them in a process of actually adapting the intervention with us, in partnership with us? And we are adapting it with them to, in order to build the capacity for them to actually deliver this care. So that's sort of where we bring implementation science to help us do that process in the community. So our local context, a public outpatient mental health clinic in Upper Manhattan, serves mostly Latino adults with serious mental illness, mostly of Dominican descent. It's staffed by social workers, psychiatrists, some peer specialists, and people with lived experiences with mental illness who are delivering supportive services, and a psychiatric nurse. And then patients are actually referred out to the community for primary care services. So if they need any type of primary care services, they're not delivered at the outpatient mental health clinic, they're sent out to the agencies in the community. And then hopefully communicating with the psychiatrists and the staffing about the physical health issues. So that's our local context of where we started. So why are adaptations so important needed when you're trying to do this implementation aspect? Because first of all, implementing an intervention is a social process. It takes people. It is bringing interventions into a new setting and the setting trying to figure out how to use this intervention. So there's a whole aspect of your how do you adapt to different sources of component or sources of adaptation that is not only adapting to the client, but also adapting to the provider, to the context, to the agency. I always, to me, as I learn about implementation science, to me, implementation so requires a mutual adaptation. It's like a marriage that is working if it's implemented correctly. If it's not, it's like a divorce. But it is like a marriage. In a sense, it's a mutual adaptation, meaning the intervention never fits perfectly in the context in which you want to implement it. So you have to adapt the intervention, and you also have to adapt the context. You have to pay attention to those aspects. And context here is almost everything under the sun. It is the providers. It is the administrators. It is the community. So having to make sure that there's a fit between these two things, and how do you bring that together? And then it's people. It's people who are actually implementing this. It's a collaborative endeavor. They might not like each other. They might have not worked with each other. But in order to do this, you have to bring people together. So how do you partner, create those partnerships and connections that are needed? Those are the basic assumptions, as I see it, of what implementation is. And the assumptions we're making in the process that I'm going to be explaining. Right. So what we did, we developed this collaborative intervention planning framework, which is basically we bring the stakeholders, the people that have a stake on the intervention, clients, providers at multiple levels, so social workers, primary care physician, the psychiatrist, the nurse, the peer specialist, and we bring them together with the researchers. And that's all great. And then we use participatory, community-based participatory principles. Share health concern, ownership, co-learning, capacity building, all of that is a classic CVPR. To me, when I began this work, was like, okay, I bring these people together, what are we going to do? What's going to happen in those meetings? How are we going to take an intervention from point A all the way to point B? And how do we make that transformation happen? And for that, we needed a methodology. We needed a map to help us do that. And that's where we bring in intervention mapping, which is a procedure in public health of how do you take an intervention from theory all the way to practice. And helps us provide activities, provides agenda, provides things that we can do as a group to make that intervention happen. And I'll show you some of these steps. And the idea is at the end of the day, you have an intervention ready to go and be able to pilot test it with this process. And that we're documenting this process along. So not only we're doing this exercise to get the intervention there, we're actually documenting each of those steps so that we can replicate this, hopefully, with another community agency in another attempt. In a sense, developing a manual of community engagement with this particular process. So, as I mentioned, the key aspect, CVPR provided us the principles in which we're going to be working together, and intervention mapping provided us the means of putting that partnership into action, the steps that we're going to take to do so. So here's sort of the steps that we have, step 1 through 6. We have to set the stage. We have to bring these people together. We have to develop partnership. We need to analyze the problem in which we're working, our outpatient mental health clinic, with these types of issues. Bring in this intervention, we review the intervention together, and we begin to do the adaptation. I'm going to show you different aspects of this because of the interest of time. I can't go through all these steps. We'll be here forever. But I'll give you some examples of key aspects that we did. And we have a publication that actually explains the whole process of how we did it. So let's talk about the adaptations, because I think that's what people wanted to talk about. So our intervention is basically this: Bridges to Better Health and Wellness. It was adapted from PCARE. Basically, it's a healthcare manager that's navigating between the mental health provider and the primary care physicians. They're bridging, they're monitoring, they're coordinating, and then they're connecting with the patient and their support system. It's a 12-month program. You meet at least monthly with your healthcare manager, and it's delivered by social worker, MSW, at this clinic. They can meet more than once a month, but usually it was monthly visits to the healthcare manager. So in terms of the adaptation that we developed different levels. So we adapted, as I mentioned, to the providers and then different types of cultural adaptations, both at the surface level, making sure that people understood the intervention, that it felt natural to them, and more at a cultural, deeper level, where we embedded aspects that were not part of the intervention in order to make it even more salient for our population. So I'll give you three examples of the type of adaptations that we did. So at a basic level, care coordination. This is a healthcare managed intervention. We have to coordinate from one side to the other. In the original trial, care coordination was basically a one-to-one affair from one mental health clinic to one primary care clinic. Big clinics, don't get me wrong. These are huge public clinics, but it's really one organization to the other. Our reality was one mental health clinic to 17 different primary care clinics. There are not 17 up here, just they didn't fit in the slide. But there were 17 in total. And the interesting thing was that these are 17 different primary care clinics with different procedures, different policies, different sizes. We have small mom-and-pop shops where it's a private physician to federally qualified healthcare centers. So the care coordination complexity of this is enormous. So we needed to change the way care coordination was done in this intervention, particularly at the what we did was really for every patient, there has to be a care coordination plan that specifies who do you need to contact, how often do you need to contact, who's the provider, what type of information do they want, when do you want to contact them, how, is it going to be a fax, telephone, smoke signals, whatever that provider wants, how is it going to be specified? And for every patient, we had to do that component. And electronic medical records didn't work here, guys, because 17 different clinics with 17 different electronic medical records, there's no way to share information here. So we had to develop ways to share the information. And one way we did a personal health record, which is basically a piece of paper that specifies everything that the patient has, their healthcare needs, their medications, their recent labs, and we share that with providers. And if the patient lost that, we gave them another one. And the patient lost it again, we gave you another one. And we made sure that we're communicating with providers in that sense. At the surface level, the health education. We need to make health education salient and attractive and fun for clients. We wanted to make sure that we provided information that people wanted to do, wanted to read, wanted to understand. So we use fotonovelas. We had done fotonovelas in other work that I've been doing as a way to improve clients' knowledge, model appropriate interaction with medical provider, and model self-management. And fotonovelas are basically comic books like this that have a soap opera narrative that then it provides you information about the health condition. Anyone wants to take a guess about what this is all about? And it's not adultery. Sweet Temptations.
STIs.
No? Interesting. Diabetes.
Yes.
Diabetes. Sweet Temptation. Who's dancing? What's going on? It's all managing diabetes. And the whole point of this is that someone wants to pick it up and start reading it. All right? And they want to start engaging in this. And this is not going to solve diabetes by any means, professor. But this is going to get the person engaged in the information so they can have a conversation with the healthcare manager. They can ask questions. So we have different ones for diabetes, for depression, for medication adherence, and for other conditions. And the idea is to get people engaged and to ask questions is what we want. It's a door opener for that conversation. So we had that type of material. And then at a deeper level, we wanted to, one of the aspects that we had learned was that people really talk about that relationship they have with their primary care physician. They wanted to get information about their views of their physical health. So on the right side, you see there sort of the normal health assessment that our intervention has, which is it's basically a survey. These are all the health conditions that you have, biographical data, but it didn't provide the person an opportunity to tell their story, to ask about, so what do you think diabetes comes from? What have you done? What do you fear about your diabetes or your hypertension? What do you do? What have you done to cope with that? So we wanted to provide them an opportunity to do that. So we used the cultural formulation interview, which is in DSM-5, and we adapted it for health. And it's basically a person-centered interview. It focuses on having the person tell their story about their illness. And actually, the mere act of asking this question already conveys cultural norms that are very salient and very accepted by our population. It is about personalismo. To tell me about your story. Tell me about where you come from. Tell me about what you're suffering, and tell me how you're managing with that. And that provided an opportunity for healthcare managers to really get a deeper understanding of the person's physical health issues. This wasn't easy to do. Healthcare managers really resisted this one, but we stuck with it, and it was really important because it opened conversations that we would have missed if we only asked that type of health assessment, particularly as we're helping people manage the comorbidities that are happening in their lives. All right. So here's the logic model. This is the same logic model of PCARE. And what I'm showing you here is sort of the adaptations that we did. We did not change any of the core components of PCARE. We're still doing assessment and planning. We're still doing care coordination. We're still doing client activation. We just added or augmented parts of the intervention that were necessary in order to make it work in our population. And we also examined other outcomes that PCARE didn't have because of the nature of our population. We wanted to look at the patient's assessment of chronic illness care, their activation, and their self-efficacy, because we thought these are some of the things that our intervention could be working or activating upon. Any questions thus far?
Is the entire population Medicaid eligible?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is. Since it's in the public mental health system, everyone's Medicaid. There's some Medicare, but mostly Medicaid. So we didn't have, in this particular story, anyone that didn't have a health insurance. In order to be part of this public mental health clinic, they will have to have a health insurance, and a part of their intake is that they will get the person health insurance.
So when you developed this logic model, did you also work with the community, the healthcare providers?
Yes. So this logic model actually puts it all together with them. Part of the intervention mapping is to actually build a logic model of the problem and then a logic model of the intervention. And they are the community, as we're doing this, our stakeholder group is involved in this process. And beginning to put together where we're going to put all the components, and they helped us develop the materials that we ended up doing. Yeah.
Did you have to work with Ben Druss and
we
his
did.
Model? And at the end, would he still call this peak care, or is he calling?
We have many conversations about that. That's a great question. In many ways, it is still peak care because we're still using the same component, but it's adapted to the Latino community. And Ben was involved in making sure that we're not sort of destroying the core components. So we checked back with him on all these components. But it's interesting because in his work, he's taken it to a different direction and included other components to the healthcare manage, which we didn't do. So we've had many discussions about this. And you'll see why he took it in a really interesting direction that we didn't do, and I'll talk a little bit why that should be there.
Cool. Were all the participants U.S. born, or was it a mix of...
That's a great question. I'll show you that shortly. Most of them were not U.S. born. Most of them are immigrants, but they've been in the United States for many years. I think the average was 30 years or something like that. So most of them are immigrants, mostly from the Caribbean region, Dominican and Puerto Rican. All right. So let's see if this worked. That's sort of why we're here. We did all this stuff. Did we have an impact? So this was part of a career development award, so we wanted to do this whole process in 5 years. So the idea here was not to test the effectiveness of the intervention, but to test its feasibility, acceptability, and begin to examine its initial effects. So as you will see, this is a small pilot of the initial impact that this intervention is having in preparation for a larger trial. So we test basically feasibility. Can we deliver? Can social workers deliver the intervention? Is it acceptable? Do people show up? Do people stay with the intervention? And how do they react to intervention? And then initial intervention effects on key aspects or key outcomes. So as I mentioned, this is a setting. We did a 12-month pre-post one-group design. And this was interesting. As part of a care award, I had originally developed an RCT. And the review committee came back and said, no. You're going to be underpowered. You're not going to have enough time to do that full RCT. Focus more on the adaptation and implementation, and then do a one-group design. So we ended up doing that. And there's some, as you will see, costs and benefits of doing this type of stuff. But at the end, I think it was the right design for this type of approach. We did structural interviews and medical chart abstractions, so we were not only relying on self-report data, we also went and abstracted information from the medical charts at the public mental health clinic, as well as those 17 different primary care clinics in the community to see if people received their primary care. That was a nightmare to do that. I have never encountered so many different things in my life on how you get medical records from people, but we did it, and we had good data from it, but it was a nightmare to do that. Electronic medical records should be like universally available to everyone. And then we did 3 post-intervention focus groups. We had a sample of 34 Latinos with SMI and at risk for cardiovascular disease. So these are people that are overweight or obese, BMI of 25 or above, have hypertension, are current smoker, have diabetes or high cholesterol, basically anything under the sun. And in this population, 95% of clients will meet any of those criteria for cardiovascular disease. And we wanted to keep it really broad in that sense. We develop our intervention manual. We review, we code it as much as we can, all the audio tapes of these sessions. And then we have weekly meetings with our healthcare managers to provide them feedback, and monthly supervision meeting with the larger team and a primary care physician to help us sort of troubleshoot aspects that come on. Remember, these are social workers who are delivering this healthcare manager. We did content analysis for the focus group and linear mixed model, adjusting for the healthcare assignment. We have 2 healthcare managers. One healthcare manager was someone employed at the agency who had worked there for 20 or more years, and we trained her to do this extra job, basically. And then we brought in a master-level social worker who were basically one of our doctoral students who had clinical experience, and we trained them to do that. So we had 2 healthcare managers delivering the care for these 34 people, caseload of around 15 individuals. So here's our measure, feasibility, acceptability, and intervention outcomes. All the measures were translated in Spanish and validated in Spanish, and provided us an opportunity to examine not only the outcome, but also some of the processes that we were examining. All right. So overall, we had recruitment enrolled 77%. We have 54 people who were referred, 34 enrolled at baseline, and 85% completed the intervention. So people, if we got them, they stay with it. We only lost 5 people, 4 dropouts and 1 follow-up, and 1 loss to follow-up. So we had good completion rates. And this actually models the RCT that Ben did around a completion rate around 70-something percent. We had a smaller sample, of course. We were more, in many ways, easier to capture this individual. The intervention is a year-long intervention. So overall, not only did people come to intervention, they got exposed to intervention substantially. They came, the average visit around 10 of 12 visits, with a median of 10 to range from 5 to 13, 93% attended 9 or more visits. So people did come. They liked this intervention. They liked their healthcare manager. They were receiving a service that really addressed some of their needs. And then, as I said, 5 people dropped out, 4 by the second visit, 1 by the third. This is a question I've been having. I've been presenting this in different settings. And someone always asks, so how much time did it take to deliver this intervention? So we have some data that we're still analyzing on it. And per session, it's around 80 minutes. 47 of those are in-session components. 15 minutes are around care coordination. That's calling, faxing, figuring out where the information is at. 10 minutes sharding, and then 7 minutes on average on client outreach, calling the client, reminding them of their appointment, and things like that. Overall, basically a caseload of 15 individuals, someone has a part-time employee, basically, providing this type of intervention, for as far as we can see. You have a question, Ricky?
Yeah, I was just wondering, with the healthcare manager, did you guys consider using the peer specialist instead, and why did you choose the social worker?
That's a great question. We chose the social worker because of the complexities of the healthcare issues that we were facing. And we were, for this intervention, the original intervention was nurses. So going from nurses all the way to peer specialists seemed like a strange, we didn't know. That might be a leap too far. So we picked a social worker because there were more there, and this was something the social workers were already doing. Meaning when we talked to social workers at this clinic, healthcare issues was something that they were dealing with in the day in and day out. The other component is that we're not only connecting people, we're also checking upon whether they're receiving preventive primary care, they need to convince the primary care physician to do things, and we're coaching the individual around physical health issues. So there's a little bit more than just connecting someone and dropping them in primary care services. There's something else, and a professional might be able to do that aspect of it. And to tell you the truth, having done it, I think the peer specialists have a role in that connection and engaging, but in the aspect of convincing a primary care doctor to deliver some type of care, I don't know if a primary care doctor, primary care doctors are great, but a social worker had challenging telling a primary care doctor, you need to do X, Y, and C. There's, you know, this person is missing these labs. You haven't, you know, where are the results? Peer specialist might not have that authority. There's a role here for them, don't get me wrong, but I just don't know if it's a complete role for this type of intervention. Right, so our characteristics are mostly female, mean years of education around 10, mostly are born in the Dominican Republic, monolingual Spanish speakers, even if they've been in the U.S. for many years, around 2, almost 3 chronic medical condition. And what's interesting here is most people were going to primary care. This intervention was not about getting people that were not going to primary care to go to primary care. These people were going to primary care. The issue was what type of care they're receiving, how engaged they are in that care. Just because someone goes to primary care doesn't mean that their health is going to improve. This was all about making sure that they're going to primary care and really benefiting from primary care services. That's a different than other population and other interventions that are out there. People were staying out of the ER, which was good. And in mental health, what we have is a sample that's mostly of schizoaffective disorders and major depression. These are not mutually exclusive, but those are the major chart diagnoses that they have. And these are people who are receiving good mental outpatient mental care. They're staying out of the hospital, basically, for psychiatric issues. They're stable in the community. So that's another component when we think about this population. And people who may want to use this intervention, these are sort of the characteristics that we have. So in terms of acceptability, we did a client satisfaction questionnaire, which is one way of looking at acceptability. And a lot of people, basically, as you can see here, like the intervention. To me, this data is sort of a little suspect because it's a client. In the work that I do, I've always done client satisfaction questionnaire, and I never had anyone tell me, this service sucks. This is bad services. This is usually highly socially desirable. They've received a great services. They like the care. So this tells you people did like it, but this is not the whole story, is what I'm trying to say. And you have to be careful with those client types of questionnaires, not the whole thing. But these are people liked it. To me, we also asked, what is it that you liked about it? And then have people talk to us about it, and then we were able to code it. And most people like that health education, those fotonovelas, the opportunity to learn about their physical health issues. That relationship they formed with the healthcare manager became really important. And we have a qualitative paper currently under review where we really dig into that relationship that they form. And people describe that relationship like a family member. They really form a close relationship with that healthcare manager, someone who can help them, who coordinates care with them, and who helps them sort of understand their physical health issues and advocates for them. So that was really important for them. And then the care coordination, having someone to call them about their, remind them about their visits, making sure information is not getting lost, making sure someone is involved in that coordination. And then other things like activation and health benefits. Right. So in terms of outcomes, so remember, it's a one-group design, basically baseline to 12 months. And what we saw was significant improvement over the course of 12 months on patient activation. This is a measure, the PAM, basic patient activation measure, of someone's involvement in their own healthcare. And it actually improved from stage 3 to 4, so people starting to get engaged to really getting engaged in their own care. People also improved in their self-efficacy. They felt more confident talking with their doctor and managing their illness, their chronic illness. And then this assessment, the patient assessment of chronic illness care, is this measure about whether you're receiving good chronic medical care from the patient's perspective. Is your healthcare manager helping you do X? Is the healthcare manager activating you? Is the healthcare manager providing good coordination? Is the healthcare manager giving you a list of your medication? Is the healthcare manager explaining what each medication does? And we saw an increase on that. And the ES are the effect sizes for each of those changes over time. What we didn't see are improvement in quality of life, mental health or health-related quality of life. There was an increase, but it wasn't significant. And then we saw no movement on health outcomes, meaning their weight, their blood pressure did not improve. We have blue glucose, none of that improved. And that's something that we need to talk about. And we've been reflecting upon that. We did see major improvement in the receive of preventive primary care. So these are basically the percentage of people that receive the appropriate preventive primary care services that they need around physical exams, screening, labs, vaccination. Did your doctor tell you about sunscreen? Did your doctor tell you to quit smoking? And these are adjusted for age and for gender. So depending on your age and your gender, you have a series of services that you should receive in a year for preventive primary care services, and this is the percentage who actually received it. And we increased it from, there was an increase over the year of 29, 30% almost to 55%. And that actually models the increase that Ben Dross found in his trial as well. So there was an increase on having someone go to primary care and activating the primary care physician and saying, hey, this person needs X, Y, and Z, please provide it, and having the client and the healthcare manager follow up on that care. And that's good to see, and this is all chart abstraction data. So in a sense, at least someone recorded that they received these services. The only one that didn't increase significantly was the men screening, prostate screenings, or anything like that. That was the only one we saw an increase, but it wasn't statistically significant. So in the end, what we have seen is, so Latinos, like other people with serious mental illness, they face a constellation of barriers in accessing and using primary care. And by understanding sort of what those barriers are, and really working with communities around how to address those barriers, then we can begin to address them. And so Bridges to Better Health and Wellness is one approach that can be used and show some promising components, initial evidence that it might address the healthcare needs of the Latino population. We also, at least in our settings, Bridges to Better Health and Wellness is feasible to deliver with social worker with the right supervision as well as the right training. And we saw significant improvement over the course of 12 months on patient-centered outcomes, patient activation, self-efficacy, patient's assessment of chronic illness care, and the receiver of preventive primary care services. We did not see improvement in health. And that, to us, is really important because in many ways, we are not targeting health in this intervention. We're targeting your connection to care. But if that care is not working correctly, it doesn't matter what we connect you to, your health is not going to improve. So what we've learned from this intervention is that this is important. We need to connect people to primary care, but there also needs to be something else to begin to target the health outcomes we're looking at, the blood glucose, the hypertension, the cholesterol levels. There has to be other types of interventions that are augmented to this connection, because connecting people from one place to the other, if they're not following through what needs to happen in chronic illness care, they're not going to get better. Those health outcomes are not going to improve. So that's sort of where we're at this point of figuring out what other interventions need to be part of this package. In terms of limitation, this is a one-site study, and it's a site that was an early adopter, meaning this is a community who identified a need, who was really involved in this project, who wanted to do this, and actually benefited from this process. This is not your run-of-the-mill public outpatient mental clinic. This is someone. This is a place where they really wanted to do that. So that's something to take into consideration if we're going to move this to a different setting. That engagement of that setting becomes really important. It's a small sample. It's a single group design. We don't have a comparison group, and that's sort of where we're going. How to then take this and do a more rigorous examination, a more rigorous test with a controlled clinical trial to examine the impact that this is having. So in the end, one of the things is that what we have is that local adaptation can help address local needs and local implementation gaps, that it's important to look at those at where the interventions are going to be delivered and how to work with your local stakeholders to adapt with. So one of the things that the benefits of doing it in this approach is that when we left, when NIMH fundings ran out, the healthcare manager was still there. The social workers already had this experience and could deliver aspects of this intervention. They continue to do so. And we have activated not only the clients, we've activated the clinic. The clinic is now involved more in healthcare components. There's still major issues. Who's going to pay for this? There's a major healthcare reform happening in New York. But this clinic is sort of primed now with this experience to continue to do some of this work. And then in terms of science, it's really the develop the science of adaptation. Can we replicate this model in different agencies that have different types of interests? Can we do the collaborative intervention planning approach as an implementation strategy that we can use this approach to move interventions in different areas and see if we can actually replicate that process and then test its effectiveness in a more rigorous manner? So not only test the intervention, but also test the implementation strategy. Because this was more than just training. This was engaging a whole group of stakeholders within an agency to deliver the intervention. There was planning involved, there was restructuring, there's education, there's data that's being used. So how do we then package that as an implementation strategy and test it in a larger sample? And that's all I have. Yeah.